Hello and welcome to the History of Singapore, episode 35, The Turning Point. Going into Singapore's 1959 general election, there really was only going to be one winner. Unlike the 1955 elections, where the result was a massive surprise, the big question facing Singapore in the 1959 elections was, just how much would the People's Action Party win by? Let's take a look at the state of the various parties going into the election. The PAP, of course, were the front runners, and their leader, Lee Kuan Yew, was sitting pretty. Thanks to the detentions of his party rivals and the party reorganization that excluded anyone he did not trust, Lee Kuan Yew was in firm control of the PAP. The party was unified and he was unchallenged in leadership. He confidently told British Governor William Goode that he had removed communists from all positions of influence in the party and had, quote, buttoned up, unquote, the party so that communists could no longer get in. He guaranteed that no communists would stand on the PAP ticket for the 1959 elections, a highly ironic guarantee given what would happen in 1962. From mid-1958, Lee had also begun planting trusted people within the trade union movement. On 11th of January 1959, he achieved control of the Singapore General Employees Union, which was the successor union to the famous Singapore Factory and Shopworkers Union, at an extraordinary general meeting of the SGEU on 11th January 1959, when his supporters were elected to key positions. So it was indisputable that the PAP and the trade union movement, its grassroots base, was firmly under his control. By contrast, his rivals were in various stages of disarray. The Workers' Party had prospered by attracting left-wing anti-colonial activists who had departed from the Labour Front and PAP in disgust. But Party President David Marshall struggled to control its radical left-wing, led by Party Vice President Chang Yen-tong. After an internal struggle, Marshall emerged victorious. Chang resigned from the Workers' Party, taking his supporters with him. David Marshall, having learned from his previous experience in the Labour Front, had secured written pledges from his party members that if they resigned from the party, they would also resign from their elected offices. Accordingly, on 25th May, Chang Yen-tong resigned from the City Council, citing his disagreement with Workers' Party policy. The Chinese press were not surprised by this, as the Workers' Party had been struggling through this conflict for weeks and it had burst out into the open a few times. But when Lee Kuan Yew heard of Chang's resignation, he quite excitedly assumed that the MCP had come through for him, that the plan the leader of the MCP in Singapore had instructed through the network, he had instructed Chang Yen-tong to resign. It will remain forever an open question whether it was due to the MCP connection that Chang resigned, because the MCP leader in Singapore, the plan, Fong Chong Pi or Fong Chong Pik, admitted that he had no idea whether it was on his orders. That's how the MCP was by 1958. No one actually knew who was who or where. Even the guy who was supposed to be in charge didn't know. It was broken, fragmented, its lines of communication smashed by special branch. So the plan had no idea. He simply passed the message on, left it in the usual places, in the drops, and hoped that it got out there. But if you follow the Chinese press, the conflict between Marshall and Chang played out over such a long period of time, and Chang fought so hard to stay in and take over the Workers' Party. And he almost succeeded in staying. So on the balance, it seems unlikely that Chang resigned under orders from the plan, but rather due to internal party politics. Still, this is one of those questions that it's simply impossible to prove either way. We'll never know. To fill Chang's seat in Kallang, the PAP nominated trade unionist and former detainee Buang Bin Omar Junid, who was one of the former members of Singapore UMNO's left wing. He had defected from UMNO with 60 supporters and set up a PAP branch in Geylang Serai, which was just next door to Kallang. The Labour Front nominated journalist Lim Sopon. Voter turnout on 26 July rose by nearly 2,000 on the back of furious campaigning by the parties. And just before the election, The plan sent Lee Kuan Yew a message indicating that Wang had the complete support of the Malayan Communist Party underground. But Wang won by just 713 votes, and especially in a trade union-heavy constituency. This was a surprise. Public approval of the PAP's performance in the city council thus far remained high. And yet, Wang won by a mere 713 votes out of well over 8,300. In retrospect, this should have been Lee's first clue that perhaps the Singapore MCP wasn't the force that he thought it was. It really was just one lone man hiding from the government, not some huge force, some huge underground conspiracy with its tentacles everywhere. Now, as for the Labour Front, before the by-election, Chief Minister Lim Yew Hong unexpectedly announced that the ruling Labour Front Party would be dissolved. A new United Socialist Front that combined the Labour Front and the Liberal Socialist Party would take its place, consolidating the anti-PAP opposition into a single party. This consolidation appeared to signal a move towards a two-party system, which the vernacular press approved of. It was a sign of the rapidly growing maturity of Singapore's political system, and also hopefully signalled an end to the fissiparous politics of the past few years, when every major party had experienced splits and defections. The negotiations to create an anti-PAP United Socialist Front, however, took nearly a whole year. Labour Front ministers, Labour Front leaders, and British officials grew frustrated with Lim Yew Hock's quote-unquote manoeuvring and intriguing and lack of leadership. Francis Thomas, one of the Labour Front leaders, privately contrasted Lim's manoeuvres and his lack of leadership with Lee Kuan Yew's genuine, firm, right-wing leadership. Francis Thomas privately declared that really he would have no problem with Lee Kuan Yew winning the next election because then Singapore would have a genuine leader. Governor William Goode described the United Socialist Front as, quote, many footsteps heard upstairs, but nobody coming downstairs, unquote. People felt that the United Socialist Front was opportunistic rather than principled. Lee Kuan Yew, however, took the threat seriously. He offered Lim a place in his cabinet, or his pick of ambassadorships, if he dropped the United Socialist Front idea. Lim declined, but perhaps he should have accepted. When it was finally created, it had a divisive rather than uniting effect. It was called the Singapore People's Alliance, or SPA, and it drew members from the Labour Front, the Liberal Socialist Party and the Workers' Party together and replaced the Labour Front in government. However, not all of the members of those parties were willing to join. Francis Thomas, one of the founders of the Labour Front, refused to close it down. He attacked the Singapore People's Alliance as dishonest and blatant political opportunism. Francis Thomas subsequently resigned from government and was widely praised for his principles. The resignation of the man dubbed, quote, the only honest man in the Labour Front, unquote, was a massive blow to the government. From the Workers' Party, 14 leaders joined the Singapore People's Alliance, but not David Marshall. He too thought it was unprincipled opportunism, but more importantly, he wasn't going back to work with Lim Yew Hock after their bad experience with each other. The former radical left-wing Workers' Party members, led by Chang Yen-tung, who had left the Workers' Party, now considered returning to the rump of the Workers' Party. But to Lee Kuan Yew's consternation, they decided to establish their own party, the Singapore Citizens' Party. Lee had expected that Chang and his supporters, under instructions from the MCP to throw in their lot with the PAP, would then rally to the PAP and join the PAP, but instead they started their own party. This should have been his second clue that Chang and his followers weren't taking orders from the MCP. The new party had one assemblyman, the formerly independent Seah Ping Chuan. Singapore UMNO, too, was riven by opposing factions. Samad Ismail, now back in Singapore, joined UMNO and stood for its leadership against Hamid Jumat. Hamid favoured working with the PAP but demanded to run in 10 constituencies unopposed by the PAP as the price of coalition. Samad, however, was opposed to any accommodation with the PAP. Hamid just managed to see off the challenge, and the UMNO Central Committee voted 7-7 to expel any member found supporting the PAP, and the motion was passed only by the chairman's casting vote. Following this, Pak Samad would move permanently to Kuala Lumpur and Singapore would lose one of our greatest sons. We simply don't know enough about Pak Samad, who made such a massive contribution to Singapore's anti-colonial movement and our literary culture. So that's the situation. You have two major parties, the government, which included the Singapore People's Alliance, Singapore UMNO and Singapore MCA. In opposition, the PAP. And then the other smaller parties, the rumps of the parties who had seen their best members join, or maybe their most opportunistic members, to be more accurate, join the Singapore People's Alliance. And these included the Labour Front, Workers' Party and Liberal Socialist Party. And then the Singapore Citizens Party, which no one seems to have taken really that seriously at this point. And then an array of smaller parties and independents, which no one really paid attention to. Join us when we return, when we talk about the election of 1959. Going into the 1959 election, the PAP was in pole position. But the governing Singapore People's Alliance, formerly the Labour Front, also shot itself in the foot through a number of mistakes. And by far, the biggest mistake, the biggest blow against the government, was the Chew Swee Kee scandal. In a pre-election rally in February 1959, the PAP charged the SPA with receiving $500,000, $500,000, from the United States government, which Minister for Education Chew Swee Kee was alleged to have converted to his own use. Chew resigned. An inquiry was appointed to investigate into the PAP's allegations. The subsequent unsavory disclosures, rumours and allegations that came to light at the inquiry hearings badly damaged the government. Personal character became a central issue of the election. Revelations that Hamid Jumaat's wife held shares in Chew's mining company rocked Singapore UMNO, costing Hamid his chairmanship of the party. The PAP attacked the SPA relentlessly, emphasising how the SPA was corrupt and incompetent, and that only the PAP could form a, quote, clean and sincere, unquote, government. In response, Lim Yew Hock declared that he could, quote, unquote, play the same game and announced that the subversives clause, banning those detained for subversion from standing in the 1959 election, had, in fact, been the result of collusion by him and Lee Kuan Yew, who had asked Lennox Boyd, Colonial Secretary Alan Lennox Boyd, to introduce the clause. Lim also announced that his strong action against subversive elements, including PAP members, had been with the endorsement of Lee. Lee immediately denied the former claim, but curiously, did not address the latter allegations that he had endorsed the repression. The Colonial Office issued a denial of the allegation, but it was carefully worded in accordance with Lee Kuan Yew's suggestion. It specifically said that there was no secret meeting between Alan Lennox Boyd, Lee Kuan Yew and Lim Yew Hock to make an agreement for the subversives clause. As listeners will recall, this formulation had been suggested by Lee Kuan Yew because it was technically true. Lee had met with Lim, Lim met with Lennox Boyd, then Lee met with Lennox Boyd. At no point in time did all three of them meet to discuss the clause. Thus, denying that all three of them had met to discuss the clause was technically true. The Nanyang Shangpao demanded to know the truth, saying that the people of Singapore had a right to know. However, there were no further revelations on the matter. But public discussion was obsessed with the numerous allegations from both sides, overshadowing the important bills that the SPA was passing and overshadowing the rest of the election campaign. The SPA's final card was to accuse the PAP of being communist agents. However, the communist argument held little water with the electorate, who had seen the PAP's performance in the city council and generally approved. Nor did they believe in Lim's argument that the 1956 and 57 arrests demonstrated the PAP's communist links, because none of the detainees had been brought to trial. On the contrary, having frequently expressed frustration with being constantly tarred with the communist brush, Chinese commentary became angrier and even more pro-PAP. The PAP, for its part, emphasized it was the party of the working class and was supported by the Singapore General Employees Union, which campaigned on its behalf. The PAP also went out of their way to criticise the English educated as a privileged group and attacked the English educated civil service as a bastion of colonialism. The PAP's platform pledged a fair deal for the working population, greater strength for unions, and government-led restructuring of the economy, including, crucially, the expansion of industrialization. This would, they declared, quote, transform a feudalistic and conservative outlook to a progressive and socialistic outlook and prepare the way for a future socialist society, unquote. The PAP's platform condemned the Preservation of Public Security Ordinance as fascist and totalitarian and declared itself for, quote, the higher human values of personal liberty, freedom, and human tolerance, unquote. As Lee Kuan Yew later wrote in his autobiography, quote, a competitive winner-takes-all society, like colonial Hong Kong, would not be acceptable in Singapore. A colonial government did not have to face elections every 5 years. The Singapore government did. To even out the results of free market competition, we had to redistribute the national income through subsidies on things that improved the earning power of citizens, such as education. Housing and public health were also desirable, unquote. But really, when it comes down to it, the crux of the issue was the poor record of the Labour Front, the Singapore People's Alliance government. The economy had grown and a base for industrial development laid, but the lack of diversification and the continued reliance on entrepôt trade made Singapore vulnerable to lower demand in its core markets. The Labour Front couldn't control the post-Korean War slump, but it took the blame for a depressed economy. Wages had fallen, and over 17,000 jobs had been lost under Lim Yew Hong, even as the workforce expanded by around 90,000 workers. So, net loss, 107,000 workers. Unemployment was estimated to be between 43,350 and 46,000, which was over 30%. And remember, the government counted anyone who worked 15 hours a week as employed. The government was blamed, especially as its policies had prioritized job creation and economic development. Voters drew a contrast between the lack of accomplishments of the Singapore People's Alliance government and the PAP's record of dictatorial efficiency in the city council. Indeed, in its desperation for votes, the government belatedly passed much important legislation, such as the creation of the HDB, the People's Investment Corporation, and a local development bill. It recognized and funded Nanta. But it also, as I mentioned, shot itself in the foot by rushing through poorly considered legislation that caused many problems. Lim also tried to win over the Chinese by releasing a number of detainees and permitting former Malayan Democratic Union leader Lim Kian Chai to return to Singapore. But then this angered the Federation of Malaya government, which severely tightened border controls between the two territories, causing public dismay in Singapore. Governor William Goode noted that opposition to the PAP had simply fallen apart in infighting. More importantly, the PAP had successfully presented itself as a clean and competent party. Goode wrote, quote, to secure the support of the Chinese-speaking, it was of supreme importance not to touch money, not to be immoral, not to break promises. The PAP was scrupulously observing these principles. Lim Yew Hock and his colleagues had forfeited the respect of the Chinese-speaking because of all the scandal about them, unquote. Good was resigned to the prospect of a PAP government and worried about it. He worried about, quote, the disturbingly totalitarian smell of much of the PAP behaviour. I do not think it is going to be easy to work with a PAP government, and I fear that Singapore is in for a hard time economically. We can only hope that the PAP will be sensible in office and willing to learn quickly. Unquote. He would be disappointed. And we'll get into that next week. But at this point, let's stop for a moment. In the past few episodes, we've gone into great detail about the political maneuverings of the late 1950s, particularly between the British colonial authorities, Singapore Chief Minister Lim Yew Hock, and PAP leader Lee Kuan Yew. But it's important to look at the bigger and broader context of 1959. Why is it a turning point? The significance of 1959 has faded in our popular consciousness. Other dates and events, most notably 1965, have surpassed our recognition of 1959 as a turning point in Singapore's history. Yet, to be alive at the time was to live through one of the most exciting, eventful years of Singapore's history. Because Singaporeans, for the first time, were taking responsibility for their own future. In the past few years, very rapidly, they had organized themselves into political parties, trade unions, and social action groups. Capable and determined, they forced the colonial authorities to recognize that Singapore would no longer be a docile colony, but that people were thirsting for their own rights and freedoms and would not be dissuaded from winning them. In the face of skepticism and discouragement by the colonial authorities, Nanyang University, Nanta, the People's University, was created. It was organized by private enterprise and funded by donations from Singaporeans of all walks of life. It was the first statewide popular campaign in Singapore's history, and it was by no means the last. It was the first of many, and these served notice to the colonial government that if it would not provide for Singapore, Singaporeans would seize back the country and provide for ourselves. Singapore's economy appeared to be finally emerging from the post-Korean War slump. New technology, epitomized by the launch of Sputnik in 1958 and the opening of the first commercial nuclear power plant in Sellafield, England in 1956, promised to revolutionize the way people lived. And the opening of Nanta in 1958 promised to herald the availability of higher education for all who desired it. The choices and possibilities opened to people living in a state which already boasted one of Asia's highest standards of living, education and medical care, seemed limitless. But the problem, of course, was that the benefits of the technological and economic transformations that were reshaping the world had, in Singapore, been largely monopolized by a privileged colonial and commercial elite, an English-speaking and generally European elite. The vast majority of Singapore's population lived in relative poverty with no social welfare provisions amidst a severe housing shortage. They could not afford private health care and queued for long hours for treatment at one of Singapore's public hospitals. There were not enough jobs being created to meet the numbers of young adults entering the workforce every year. Singapore's economy was heavily dependent by British design on the export of rubber and tin and buffeted by the fluctuations in their prices. And meanwhile, secret societies continued to rule the streets. Corruption and inefficiency infested the government and civil service. And most of all, the question of Singapore's complete independence, reunification with the Malayan mainland, and the continuation of a democratic government needed to be addressed. These were the challenges facing the new government. But for the first time, they would be given the tools of power to address them. For the first time, a locally elected, locally responsible, locally accountable government of Singaporeans and by Singaporeans for Singaporeans was going to be elected. Its only restriction would be external relations and external security. But internally, for all intents and purposes, this is the turning point. This is the point where Singaporeans are given our country for the first time. And so with so much at stake, the election campaign of May 1959 was the most open and hotly contested in Singapore's history. Apart from the fact, of course, that it had been pre-rigged by Lim Yew Hock and Lee Kuan Yew to eliminate, to exclude the popular politicians of the left wing. Apart from that massive, massive asterisk on this, you know, that massive footnote on this most important election of our history, the fact is we did really, really well. This was an election for our first self-government, and it epitomized democracy. 194 people, including 9 women, contested Singapore's 51 constituencies, with up to 7 people contesting each seat. And it was a clean and fair campaign. The parties campaigned on economic development, on clean and efficient government, on safety and security for Singapore, on ideas, on competence. Most remarkably, the election rhetoric was largely free of any reference to race or religion. Instead, the theme of the campaign was about unemployment, economic development, jobs. It was the people of Singapore against the privileged elites, and every party sought to claim the mantle of the people's voice. The People's Action Party proudly fielded many candidates from blue-collar professions, including farmers and barbers and carpenters and a seamstress. They showed that talent could come from anywhere. Anyone could step up and be a leader for Singapore, a leader of Singapore. The possibilities seemed endless. On 30th of May 1959, the PAP won a decisive majority, 43 out of 51 seats on a whopping 92.9% turnout. The SPA won only four, all in upper-class constituencies, including a very narrow Lim Yew Hong victory over David Marshall in Cane Hill. Singapore UMNO won three seats in Malay-dominated areas. Independent Indian lawyer A.P. Rajah narrowly won Farrer Park on the strength of his long association with the area. The PAP's victory was chiefly due to the support of the Chinese-speaking working classes. Its favourable record in the city council, denouncing discrimination by the English-speaking and Europeans, and its stress on economic and social issues all played a major role in winning votes. But it's important also to remember it won with just 54.1% of all votes cast and only won a majority in 30 constituencies out of 51. 54.1% was considered a huge success in 1959. Today it would be seen as a disaster by the PAP, but things are a bit different in a genuinely democratic election. The PAP struggled in areas with large numbers of non-Chinese speakers and also struggled in the upper and middle class areas. Not all Singaporeans were ready to trust the PAP. But still, Singapore was now a functioning democracy where the rights of the people would be protected and their interests attended to. A new epoch had begun. The government was fully elected, fully responsible to the people of Singapore, with complete internal control, vested with the responsibility for Singapore and to represent the interests of the common people of Singapore. Singapore still faced an uncertain future, but now Singaporeans had control of our own destinies. The future, at long last, was our very own. The PAP won the election, but how would they use the power which had been entrusted to them? They would find that winning was easy, but governing was harder. Join us next week when we detail how the PAP used and abused its power. As always, if you have any questions, comments or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjthumb. Thank you very much and see you next week.